Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to Patriot Education. My name is Terry Rowland. I'm your hostess for this evening. And as always, we are brought to you through the good offices of www.patriotfamilies.com, a great group of people who believe that we are the nation. It is fundamental to the United States of America, as stated in our Declaration of Independence, that governments derive their power from the consent of the governed. You and I, ladies and gentlemen, consent to living by the Constitution of the United States. We consent to electing our political representatives, and we consent to removing them from office by our vote if they do not do as we expect them to do based on the promises they make us. Tonight's show, our topic is the lost art of listening. I don't know whether any of you have noticed, but it seems that our young people today are very deficient in this art or skill or talent. I notice it particularly in the classroom. When I'm substituting for collaborative teachers or substituting for general education teachers, I see and hear that teachers must give directions and information and instructions anywhere from 4 to 5 times, and still the students do not follow the instructions given them. They're all about, gee, I want to talk about my cat or my dog or what my dad did, or did you hear this, that, or the other, or I used to live in the town of Gazornenplatz, Hoosie Watsit, when it's mentioned in regard to history. The ability to listen and to focus on listening appears to have diminished over the past 25 years. I am not advocating the Victorian classroom where nobody was allowed to open their mouth except the teacher, and the cane was used frequently to remind people that silence was golden. We do need to listen to our children. We need to hear their concerns, their worries, their ideas, so that we can help them understand and grow. But in a classroom, we also need to remember that we learn best when our mouths are shut and our ears are open. The number of times that I have had to raise my voice almost to shouting level to get the burr of chat shut down long enough to be able to impart information or tell the kids what they need to do on a particular worksheet or quiz or for homework astonishes me. We are a nation of talkers, ladies and gentlemen. We always have been. That's why freedom of speech is number one on the Bill of Rights. We like to speak. We have the freedom to do so. But we forget sometimes that that freedom carries with it a responsibility. In order to really learn and feel the pulse of the nation, we need to listen as well as talk. I know that sounds strange, coming from someone who hosts this is a talk show on Blog Talk Radio, where you all just have to listen to me and I do all the talking, but it works both ways, even on a talk show. This has the purpose of not only you all listening to me talk, but calling in and speaking your mind, or typing in your opinions and concerns and questions into the chat room. Or if you're not interested in talking, just listening and thinking about what is said. The art of listening includes the art of speaking. If you aren't listening when you do speak, what you say is probably not going to have a lot of relevance to the subject under discussion. And when you are a child in a classroom, part of your job is to listen to your teachers. That's why they are there. They are there to impart to you information they have gained through either academic training or life experience that you do not yet have. They are there to give you the skills and the tools that you need to build upon to make yourself ready for adulthood. If the entire class time is spent reminding the students that they must be quiet in order to understand what's going on and learn something new, how much learning actually happens? I'll give you an example from my experiences today. Because I did not have students in my in-school suspension room, there was supposed to be a student there, but the child was absent, so I was available to fill in for a missing special education teacher who works in collaborative classes in the sixth grade. In 4 out of 5 of the classes in which I was substituting, the students took 15 minutes of the class time, which is approximately 1 hour, to settle down and listen to the instructions and the assignment for their classwork for the day. That means that out of that 1 hour of instruction time, the teacher had to waste 15 minutes, one quarter of the time, reminding students to stop talking, reminding them that what they needed, reminding them to write down their homework and their agenda, checking that they had done so, helping students who hadn't paid attention the first time by repeating the instructions 3 times minimum and up to 5 times in certain of those classes. When you send your child to school for a 7.5 hour day, 1/2 hour of that time is going to be devoted to lunch, usually in most public schools. The other 7 hours is supposed to be devoted to instructional and learning time. The way that my school works, our students have 4 1-hour periods per day, each of which is dedicated to one of the 4 basic subject content areas: mathematics, science, social studies, and English or language arts. If it takes 15 minutes of each one of those periods to go over instructions, to even start the educational process, that means those kids have lost 1 hour of instruction time out of the 7 that they had left. 2 hours, an hour and a half, 90 minutes of their day is spent in electives, either physical education or art, music, foreign language, computer training, etc. So that's another 90 minutes off that 7.5 hour day. So now we're down to, we lose a half hour for lunch, we lose another hour and a half for electives, that's 2 hours off, we lose another hour in wasted time repeating instructions, okay, that's 3 hours off. That means your children, in a 7.5 hour day at school, get, if they're lucky, 4 hours of educational experience. 4 hours out of a 7.5 hour day. Slightly more than half of the day is actually spent in learning the material that they're expected to master in order to proceed to their next grade level and to build the skills they need for their future as adults. My friend Linda just said in the chat room, that's what our government happens when government runs anything. It's good at wasting time and wasting money, and she's right. When you look at the amount of time that our kids spend chit-chatting, being reprimanded for talking, being pulled back with their attention to the material being given, the time the teacher has to spend in paperwork and following this and attending IEP meetings and having professional development and having department meetings and having conferences with parents on the phone during their planning time, how much of your child's day is actually giving that child the skills they need? For those of you who may own a business or work in one, who are seeing young people coming into the workforce for the first time, either directly from high school or after a college education, I wonder how many of you have noticed how long it takes you to explain to your new hires exactly what their duties are and to get them to understand their responsibilities in the workplace. I would be really, really interested if somebody would do a survey, you know, the government is really big on surveys and polls. I would like them to get an honest survey out there among business owners as regarding how long it takes for a person newly hired to actually understand what they're supposed to be doing and be able to do it without constant one-on-one supervision. I'm going to take a guess that it takes anywhere from 2 weeks to 3 months, depending on the new hire. My friend Linda was watching Glenn Beck's show tonight, as was I, and she mentioned that he has a prototype city that he's planning to build. Mr. Beck is a dreamer, God bless him, and if he's going to dream, he's going to dream big. And Linda suggests he might want to, I might want to contact him because he's looking for innovative ways to educate kids. And believe me, if I didn't have to move to Texas, I'd be on the phone right now. But I'm kind of firmly rooted in Virginia. There are better ways, ladies and gentlemen. There are much better ways. The lost art of listening is one area that we need to explore. When you are raising your children, do you expect them to actually listen to you when you say something? Do you have conversations with your kids where you speak a thought and they think about it and then they talk back related to the thought? Or do you have monologues where you know they're not listening to you, so you say the same thing 20 times in hopes that maybe it'll penetrate eventually? I saw on the Fox News Channel this year a really, really good documentary that was narrated by Juan Williams. Now, I'm not particularly fond of Mr. Williams' political views. He tends to be on the left side of the spectrum, and I'm on the right. But he did a very good job as a narrator. This documentary was about fixing our public education system, new and better ways to educate our children to live in and work in a modern, technologically developing world. My friend Oz mentioned we don't really need to innovate. We just need to cut out the Bloom and Pavlov and the other left-wing theories and turn education back into a disciplinary art. And he definitely has a point. That is part of, basically, innovation. Because innovation doesn't mean throw out the baby with the bathwater. Innovation means find better ways to do what you're doing. And if those better ways existed in the past, look at them and implement them now. Classroom discipline, the idea that the function of the student is to listen and learn, and the function of the teacher is to explain, elucidate, and share knowledge, would be a wonderful innovation because it is no longer there. We have gone so far toward the self-esteem building, anti-bullying, kumbaya, feel good about yourself aspect that progressive educational theorists have pretty much slipped into our educational system that we've forgotten that self-esteem is not based on, gee, aren't you wonderful, 27 times a day. Real self-esteem grows from mastery of something that has been difficult or required effort. If we required of our children that they put forth the effort of listening in class instead of screaming about how they need a copy of the quiz while they're taking it so they can write the answers down from the copy, which I had a student complain that he didn't get today because he's under the impression that his individualized education plan allows him to copy from a completed quiz onto his own paper and get a grade for it. He isn't required to listen. He isn't required to learn. He is only required to copy something and tell himself he got an A. Our place in the world, ladies and gentlemen, as individuals and as a nation, is dependent upon our own willingness to put forth effort to make ourselves better, more knowledgeable, more skilled, more creative, more innovative, more inventive. We cannot do this as a nation or as individuals if we are never challenged, if we are never told and had it made clear in the telling that nothing worth having comes easily. We live in a soundbite culture where 30-second commercials are memorized by children ages 2 and up, but multiplication tables are not. We are so attuned to the one-word campaign with no substance and no concrete fact that we have elected a president whose ideas are that we are not in any way exceptional, that we must apologize for our success, that we are to bow to anyone who exists in the world simply because they exist, and tell our children that they cannot learn to differentiate between right and wrong, because if they did, they might offend someone. We are spending all of our time in public education, ladies and gentlemen, deliberately crippling our electorate. We are telling them that they never have to think. They never have to try. They never can be allowed to fail. That all they have to do is say, "I'm sorry," and inappropriate behavior gets wiped off the slate, and they're free to do it again and repeat the "I'm sorry." I dealt with a student today who tried that, and he was quite shocked, and it set him back on his heels when I told him, "No, I don't accept your apology because you don't mean it." I'm sorry doesn't count if the behavior continues. I will accept your apology when I see appropriate behavior. I don't think anybody ever explained that to him before in that way. If nothing else, maybe there was a slight shakeup in the me attitude he has toward education. I have been involved with teaching and with educating for about 40 years now, as a private tutor in professional, as a substitute teacher, as a paraprofessional, and even in jobs that were not directly connected to education. I was educating people. It's what I do. It seems to be my destiny, no matter how hard I kick against the pricks, as they say, or try to find a different path, I always seem to be led or driven or urged back to my purpose in life, which is to offer what I have learned freely to those who wish to learn it themselves. One of the ways in which we can improve our educational system, ladies and gentlemen, over and above working on that lost art of listening with our kids at home, is to start listening to our teachers, our school administrators, our members of school boards, our superintendents. And while we're listening, think about what they are telling us. And then, having used the art of listening, use our freedom of speech to say, "Wait a minute, why are you doing this, and what do you expect to gain from it? We had a horrible event just prior to Christmas in Connecticut. Schools across the nation have imposed new security protocols, gotten panicky about how to protect children from insane people with a desire to kill. And in all the furor and all the shriekings of take everybody's gun away, that way nobody can ever come into a school and kill a bunch of children, nobody has paid attention to the fact that the elementary school in Connecticut did everything right. They had excellent security. They had a protocol in place to protect their kids from unwanted intruders. And still, 26 people died. We are so busy shouting about how can we make life risk-free that we forget to listen to the lessons of history that tell us that risk-free is only possible when there is no free. As horrible as events like Connecticut and Columbine are, we do not learn the correct lesson from them if all we do is scream about how can we prevent crazy people from doing crazy things. And the secret to that, the answer to that, if we would listen to history, is that we cannot prevent crazy people from doing crazy things. All we can do as a society is apprehend them, if possible, and do our best to remove them from society so they cannot repeat their heinous acts. All the gun control in the world will not stop an insane person with no ability to empathize with others from doing an insane act. There is no society on earth, ladies and gentlemen, that is perfect, because human beings are not perfect. The art of listening doesn't just mean paying attention in a classroom. It also means listening to the reality of life. And the reality of life is that there are, in this world, sociopathic personalities who are incapable of following what we consider to be morality and ethics, because to them, the only morality and the only ethic is what I want comes first, and whoever gets in my way is expendable. The only way to eliminate that kind of pathology, if you will, is to completely eliminate freedom of choice, is to pen everyone up in a box, monitored 24 hours a day, brainwashed into thinking only those thoughts that authority allows, and somehow or other preventing the birth of someone who might develop such tendencies. The progressives, as far back as the very early part of the 20th century, believed that they could create that perfect society and that perfect world by eugenics. by controlling the population's reproductive aspects so that any person who was deemed to be less than perfect would not be allowed to reproduce, and any infant who appeared to be in some fashion less than perfect would not be allowed to live. Most of the progressive thinkers that are hailed as saviors and mentors to our modern progressives, like Hillary Clinton's love affair with Margaret Sanger, either don't know or don't want to know or don't want to say that these people they honor so much were stone killers. And in order to impose that kind of total control over human beings and make life risk-free, the first step would be to remove the ability of people to defend themselves so that they would be totally dependent upon the authority figures to protect and defend them. And because they could not defend themselves against anyone, including the authority figures, they were perfectly safe, unless the authority figures decided that they didn't fit the perfect society, and then they were eliminated, either by firing squad, concentration camp, gulag, or starvation. The lost art of listening, ladies and gentlemen. If we do not listen to and learn from history, we are condemned to repeat it. Our kids need to learn how to listen. They need to pay attention and focus on what they are being taught. My friend Linda said the lost art of reading, too, and she's correct. Reading is a form of listening. Reading is listening to what the words are telling you, not just saying them out loud. The number of students that I know who can read a paragraph perfectly correctly and when asked to put it into their own words, look at you and say, huh? Is astonishing and horrifying. They aren't listening to the words. They aren't focusing on the communication the author is attempting to perpetuate. The reason that we are a developed world with incredible wealth of technology and opportunity is because reading, the written language, has given it to us. We do not have to rely on word of mouth or finding somebody who knows how to do something to learn how to fix something around our house. But because we have denied our children the instruction they need in the art of listening, we are graduating people from high school who are reading on approximately a third grade level with less than 50% comprehension. And we are telling them that they are educated. How many kids in high school have any understanding of what the Constitution actually says in the Bill of Rights? My guess is that maybe, if we're lucky, 10% of high school seniors understand what the Bill of Rights is saying. Most of them are relying on talking heads And even then, they're not listening. They're just accepting. And they're hearing what they want to hear. Well, I'm entitled to this, or this is my right to do this, or you have to give me this, or I'm such and such, so you need to do this. They're not even listening to themselves. The people of this nation, ladies and gentlemen, are allowing their children to be turned into slaves. Yes, they are. In spite of all the rhetoric and all the anti-racist and all the politically correct, don't say this, you'll offend somebody nonsense that's going on, we are teaching our kids that they must depend upon the authority figures, government, to make life safe, comfortable, happy, and prosperous. And that the only thing they have to do is sort of show up, and all good things will be poured into their laps. Benjamin Franklin once said that the way to eliminate poverty is to make it uncomfortable. We are not going to eliminate poverty by supporting it and creating a class of people for whom that is the ultimate goal, so that you can get free money from the government. We are not going to have a nation of people who can rule themselves as a nation, because we're not going to have a nation of people who can rule themselves as individuals. Today, when I was substituting in collaborative classes, there were about four students in each of the classes who could not or would not sit still, stop talking, pay attention, complete their work, or in other ways allow the other kids in the class to have a good learning environment. And they are protected, and that behavior continues because they have been told by the Federal Department of Education and its interpretations of the Americans with Disabilities Act that the world and the classroom must accommodate to their behavior and not the other way around. I had a student today that I came very close to wanting to physically harm. Not to harm the child physically. And I didn't, and I wouldn't. But the frustration and anger I felt, were I not an individual who understood self-control, might have led to harm to that kid. But I was brought up in a society that taught me one of the most important lessons I could learn in order to become a functioning adult was self-control. That I could not and should not act out on my anger or my feelings simply because I had them. That does not appear to be part of instruction for many of our children in the special education programs of our public schools. One of the things that has come up and that people are talking about on conservative websites and television shows and so on, with regard to the shootings in Connecticut, is the predominance of violence in movies, video games, etc., and the deleterious effect this has on our kids. And they are quite right to point this out. It does have a deleterious effect because it numbs them to the reality of what violence is. It is pain and sorrow. And seeing someone you love lose their life, and they're not going to be there anymore. But there is another aspect of the violence in video games and television and movies that goes even beyond that desensitizing to pain and death. It's the aspect that says, these characters in this video game act out of emotion, so why shouldn't I? Self-control doesn't win a violent video game. Getting angry and getting rousing your fighting spirit, your berserker mode, does. If that's the ideal we hold up, if that's the norm that we promote, why are we surprised at inappropriate violent behavior? First, we desensitize children to the fact that violence actually causes physical pain to people. Then, we encourage them to pull up their worst emotional states in order to commit enough violence to be rewarded with points or going up a level or all of the other things that you get rewarded for in a video game. I see it in the classrooms. I see the inability of many children who are not special education with behavioral disabilities, but ordinary kids with no problems, okay? Who are acting out simply because they play the violent video games, and they see kids acting out and getting away with it in their classrooms. We cannot remove these children who are disruptive, because if we do, we are discriminating against them and denying them their guaranteed by the federal government right to a free, appropriate public education. And that's because we didn't listen to what they meant by a free, appropriate public education. Most of us who grew up before the advent of FAPE define the word appropriate as being proper or fitting with society's norms or suitable for the situation in which one finds themselves. Appropriate usually means abiding by the rules, mores, or manners of whatever group or society in which you find yourself. It doesn't mean that in free, appropriate public education, ladies and gentlemen. Appropriate means suited to the particular child's likes, dislikes, abilities, and inabilities. That means that what's appropriate doesn't mean that the child's behavior in class will be appropriate. Oh, no. It means that the child's behavior in class isn't their fault because they have a behavioral disability, so they can continue to act out, and we take them out and talk to them and tell them they need to do better, bring them back into class, and the behavior continues, and nobody else gets to learn. And the number of parents out there, okay, who use this appropriate aspect to remove their children for at least 7.5 hours a day so they don't have to deal with the behavior. Somebody else does. And then come to school and scream and complain and threaten to sue the place, because their child's inappropriate behavior and inability to control it has resulted in failing grades. And what do we get? We get social promotions. We get them primarily so the teachers don't have to think, oh my God, I'm going to have that kid back in my class for another year. Throw up their hands in despair and leave the profession. And a lot of them throw up their hands and leave their profession anyway, simply because they're the next class to get that same kid who cannot control him or herself and disrupts the ability of everybody else in the classroom to learn. Because we have not really listened to the consequences of many of these great-sounding slogans like "No Child Left Behind." Well, guess what, folks? You can't have that. Some children are going to be left behind. And they should be, because they have not mastered the skills they will need to go to the next level. Being left behind does not mean they're being abandoned on the top of a hillside like a Spartan baby with a club foot. It means they have not mastered what they need to know to build on it in the next grade. The student that my self-control prevented me from shaking until his teeth rattled today threw a minor hissy fit because he wasn't allowed, as I mentioned earlier, to get a copy of the quiz that he could copy instead of actually using his brain to answer the questions. And the teacher, when he approached the teacher demanding this, the teacher said no, which caused the hissy fit. And when the child finally stomped out and the teacher and I were talking about the difficulties that the child presented and what on earth are we going to do except hopefully get him through sixth grade alive and pass him so the seventh grade teachers have to deal with it, the teacher said, "I'm not going to do that because I'm not going to put my name on a lie. I'm not going to be one of those who says, oh yeah, everything's fine, he's ready to go on, and he knows enough to be able to put together this year's work with next year's work in advance." That teacher, God bless him, has integrity. But he will be vilified for it. He will have complaining parents. Because there are too many parents out there, ladies and gentlemen, who see their children as trophies. Well, my kid got all A's. Something that they can brag about as if it were a trained poodle or a highly bred bull. Not a living human being who needs to be given the tools for success. And if it takes longer for him or her to understand and integrate those tools, being willing to accept the fact that maybe one time around in sixth grade isn't enough. I've met a great many parents like that, ladies and gentlemen, and they sadden me deeply because they, like their children, don't listen. They don't listen to what is needed to be a functioning adult. Their child is an individual person, not a carbon copy, not a trophy animal, not a prize cat or dog winning a blue ribbon at a show. Their child is a living human being who deserves honesty so that he or she will understand when and whom to trust. How is that child going to grow up into a functioning adult if they cannot get honesty and trust from the people who brought them into the world? We all want to be proud of our children and grandchildren. But we have to recognize that being proud of them is not based on what we think they ought to be. Being proud of them means letting them know that when they run into troubles and it takes them longer to understand, What we're proud of is the hard work they put in to trying their best when it's hard to learn. Not in their grade, but in their effort and the knowledge they gain through it. We're not listening, ladies and gentlemen. We're not listening to common sense. We're not listening to what's behind the pretty words and the pipe dreams. We're not listening to what our children are learning and not learning. And we're not listening to the wonders of technology that could help them learn better, but are being wastefully used. I mentioned earlier that I saw a documentary hosted by Juan Williams on Fox News that talked about innovative schools. One of these innovative schools was a school called Carpe Diem. It is a prep school. It is a private prep school that goes from, I believe, 5th through 12th grade. It has about 250 students. And each student has his or her own computer desk. And they learn at their own pace using computer software, interactive Skype conversations with online teachers and mentors, teachers present that they can call on for explanation, and who monitor everything the child does so they can see what they're mastering and go and help if you see that they're not mastering something, so that the child who picks up a concept immediately doesn't have to sit there for 4 days while the child who doesn't understand it gets retaught. This is one of the ways that we could innovate and make our public education better. And many of you are probably asking, well, why don't we all do that? Well, there are lots of reasons. Number one, teachers' unions. In that type of school, you no longer need 4 adults in every classroom and the salaries we pay them to monitor and try to teach 25 to 30 students who range in ability from 2 years behind to 2 years ahead. Another barrier, the software and the understanding of the use of technology to monitor, use of iPads, use of smartphones, use of all of those things, isn't being offered as professional development. What we're getting are happy little seminars on how to make foldables. Expense. Purchasing the computers, the software, the backup systems, and purchasing teachers who are good at their job is quite often beyond the reach of most localities. And the extra funding that comes to them is being used to build pretty fancy new schools with lots and lots of computers stuck off in a room that nobody goes to except when they're doing standardized testing, and radio stations and swimming pools and nice landscaping and really pretty cafeterias and 47 special education teachers to 87 general education teachers and 40,000 teachers' aides and lots of extra guidance and, yeah. There are a lot of people out there who are looking at homeschooling, and it's more and more popular and more effective as technology improves. There are dozens of online academies and online schools, as my friend Doc mentioned in the chat room, that are available for homeschooling parents. The bar to homeschooling for a great many families is the need for 2 incomes in order to maintain the comfort of a lifestyle for the family that they've grown used to. Also, 2 incomes often are necessary if you have parents who are not educated to master's degree level and aren't bringing in $150,000 a year with a single job. There are also single parents who cannot stay home from work and teach their children. They have to have their day to go and earn the money to feed and clothe and medicate them. So homeschooling is another way that we can deal with the mess our public schools have fallen into. A combination of the two. Taking online classes, okay, for part of the day, shortening the school day so that every moment of it is instructional, and stopping worrying about being surrogate parents instead of teachers. Being able to have access for your kids to educators and educational materials so that the child's behavioral disability doesn't disturb anybody but them. There are a lot of options, ladies and gentlemen. There are a lot of ways we can change things. But unless we listen and learn about them and then turn around and speak about them to other parents and grandparents and aunts and uncles and friends and teachers and school administrators, and unless we start listening to history and recognizing that the ideal utopian world of all children are the same so they can all master the skills at the same pace and in the same length of time, and recognizing that that's not true, we will finally look at our traditional classrooms and our insane attempt to be all things to all children in a 7.5-hour day and scrap it. Because we cannot do what we are told we must do for our kids in the way that we are trying to do it now. We cannot provide a free, appropriate public education to every child in the traditional classroom setting for everybody. We cannot make education one size fits all and expect to individualize it for every single child. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is what our Department of Education and our federal government are telling your teachers they must do. And you aren't listening. I work with great teachers who are dedicated to their profession and passionate about the desire to see children learn. There are many teachers out there who are not dedicated and who are not passionate about their profession. There are many teachers who believe that because they have attained a teaching certificate, that they should be guaranteed wealth, success, and being taken care of for their entire lives after putting in their 15, 20 years in their career. I am not one of that group, ladies and gentlemen. Neither are the vast majority of teachers with whom I work and have worked. You don't become a good teacher because you want to put in 20 years sleeping behind a newspaper and then retire at $50,000 a year and relax in Florida until you die. Believe me, if that's the way you want to live, you're not going to get it as a teacher, in spite of all the teachers' unions lobbying for retirement benefits that state can't afford to pay. It's not going to happen, because the vast majority of them who hang on long enough to get those cushy retirement things have absolutely no ability to teach at all. We have got to really start listening, ladies and gentlemen. Listening and learning. The average college graduate with a teaching degree. Now, enters the profession and will probably leave it after 5 years. Because the only ones who stay in it longer are the ones who are in it for the power and the quote-unquote money. Being a teacher is a position of great power, ladies and gentlemen. You have an incredible influence when you teach children. You are given a platform and a power to influence their lives. One of my students gave me, for Christmas one year, a little desk ornament that says, "To teach is to touch a life forever." I have that on my desk at school. I have it there not because it's a compliment, but because it is an admonition to me to recognize the power I wield. What I say and how I deal with my students will touch their lives forever. I am aware of my power. I try my best to deal with my students honestly and fairly. I do not babysit. I do not give praise if it has not been earned, but I do not stint praise when effort has been put forth and the praise has been well earned. I answer questions when they are asked, but I do not give answers, nor do I tell my students that they must believe a certain thing or follow a certain political agenda, or choose a particular religion, or treat other people negatively based on some aspect of that other person's group orientation. I try to teach what I believe by example and not precept. There is no guarantee that my touch on their lives will be noticed, thanked, remembered, or praised. And I know this, accept it, and I'm fine with it. Young teachers, those who are graduating now and who will only be able to stand the profession for 5 years, don't have the benefit of my life experience. I'm very, very lucky because I have seen the proof that what I teach and what I do does touch someone forever. I have lived long enough to have children that I taught come back to me as adults with children of their own and tell me that I was a positive influence on their lives, and they remembered what I taught. That's what keeps me doing what I do. I've been very, very fortunate to have that experience. But the young teachers going into our public schools now don't have that benefit. Yes, I can tell them about it. Yes, I can relate my experience. But until and unless they believe that they too will have that experience, the stress and the strain and the frustration is very, very difficult to put up with. When they do their best in a classroom and they grade fairly and honestly on student performance and then are called on the carpet and lectured and scolded by their principal because a parent has claimed that their adorable child deserves an A, even when adorable child doesn't study, doesn't turn in homework, and gets an F on every test. And the teacher is blamed for it, because it's obvious that if the kid isn't learning, it's the teacher's fault. I have no problem with high expectations, ladies and gentlemen. I grew up with high expectations, my parents and my own. I believe in high expectations. Setting goals that require effort to achieve is essential. Setting unrealistic goals, either too high or too low, is counterproductive and dangerous. We need to explain to our kids and make sure they're listening exactly what grades are for. Grades are not a piece of candy given to you because the teacher likes you, or you emptied the wastebasket or sharpened pencils. Grades are not proof that mommy and daddy are wonderful parents. See, you've got all A's. Grades are not a guarantee that you're smart. Grades are not given to you because the teacher thinks you're cute or you're funny or likes your handwriting or is a good friend of your mom's. Grades are kind of like a thermometer. Okay. They measure something. They measure how well you have mastered a specific set of skills or body of knowledge. They are not presents given to you because you behaved well. They are not rewards for you're taller than everybody else. They're not something that you get because you're black or white or Chinese or Italian or tall or short or blonde or thin or fat or a good athlete or a cheerleader or pretty or ugly. And no, they have absolutely nothing to do with all of that. Grades measure how much you have learned and whether or not you are ready to build on that knowledge with new skills and new bodies of knowledge that grow from what you've learned now. The number of kids that I see, particularly the kids in the collaborative classes, the special education kids, who believe that a grade is given to them because the teacher likes them, if it's a good grade, or the teacher hates them if it's a bad one. A grade is a present. It's a gift. It's not a measure. It's not a thermometer. It's not a yardstick. No, it's a present. You don't earn it. Okay? You're given it because you're entitled to it for whatever reason you happen to think up at the moment. I remember many years ago when I was working as a professional tutor, One of the schools in the town in which our business was located, well, most of the schools, but one in particular I remember, sent home report cards that gave a letter grade. And they also listed the grade level at which a student was performing in each of the core subjects. And I saw a report card that was straight A's for a child who was in seventh grade. And the parents were thrilled. Look, see, he got straight A's. And then I pointed to the grade level at which the child was working. Third grade level in English. Second grade level in math. Fifth grade level in social studies. Fourth grade level in science. And the mother was absolutely floored. She had never even looked at that part of the report card. She wasn't listening, ladies and gentlemen. She wasn't listening. Oh, if you hear a kitty cat meowing in the background, his name is Red and he wants his own talk show, but I won't give it to him, so he decides he's going to talk on mine. He doesn't listen very well either. And yeah, maybe my friend Doc says he wants his supper, but not quite. Oh, Red? Rod says hello. Mostly what Red wants to do is, like a lot of my kids in school, is talk all the time. So maybe that's one of the reasons that I've learned to control myself in classrooms, because I'm used to it at home. But the good thing about my cat, Red, he may talk all the time, but he doesn't want to go to prom, he doesn't want a car, and I don't have to send him to college. And like many of the kids in class, as Rod says, he wants attention too. And that's 99% of the reason that our kids don't listen, because they've been taught to expect 100% of somebody's attention 100% of the time. And a lot of times, they don't get that. And the only way they can is by disruptive behavior. It's very, very common in collaborative classes, ladies and gentlemen, that the most disruptive children are the ones who are the farthest behind. Because instead of the almighty Department of Education's rosy view that putting children who have great difficulty learning in classes with children who don't have great difficulty is going to magically improve the abilities of the lower end and not harm the upper end in the least. And it doesn't work that way. And believe me, I am not speaking out of theory. I am speaking out of personal experience. Because our Department of Education and our progressive liberal thinkers don't listen either. A great many of their theories and their classroom management lessons and their constant mantra that if children aren't learning, it's the teacher's fault, you're just not doing it right, are based on experimental programs in university and college laboratory schools, where all of the children, almost all of the children, are the sons and daughters of tenured professors or teachers aiming for tenure, and they have inherited a degree of intellectual ability. And very few of them are special education. The other thing that people aren't listening to is utopian ideal, along with what a grade is for. They are not listening to the fact that some people will take longer and have greater difficulty learning certain aspects of academics than others. There are learning disabilities. They exist. My husband has one. He is dyslexic. Fortunately, he went to school before the Department of Education was put in place, as did I. He was never told, oh, you don't have to learn that. It's too hard for you. You're disabled, so we'll give you an A anyway. Nope. He was told, this is going to be hard for you. It's not going to come as easily as it does to some of the other kids in class. What that means is that you're going to have to work harder. That's what he was told. So he did. Because he was treated honestly. My friends in the chat room, Doc and Rod, are talking about the fact that self-discipline is important for kids to learn. And they are exactly right. And that's another way in which we are not listening. We have forgotten that in order for us to rule ourselves as a nation, we have to be able to rule ourselves as individuals. That means we can't give in to whatever emotional storm we're happening to have at the moment and take it out on everybody around us. And then say, I'm sorry, after we've shot somebody, and expect to be patted on the head and said, that's okay. And believe me, the attitudes and behaviors of some of the kids who have quote-unquote IEPs can and do lead to the, gee, I'm sorry I shot him, can I go home now, attitude of people who do commit heinous acts like that in Connecticut. When a person has a disability, or as we used to call it, a handicap, is it honest to tell that person that the world is going to bend and make life easy for them because it's full of compassion for them and wants them to be happy and it can't wait to make it easy? No. That is a lie. I do not believe that telling a child with a difficulty that you will fix things so he doesn't have to do something because of his difficulty is in any way conducive to developing self-esteem, self-discipline, and self-control. I do not believe in accommodations for behavioral disabilities. I do believe in accommodations for physical disabilities. Those types of accommodations can be put into place without eliminating the child's ability to understand that he or she is going to probably have to work a little harder at things than somebody else. Well, my friend Linda brought up a good question regarding the Carpe Diem schools where they work on computers and so on and so forth. How are you going to inspire kids to read? Well, that's part of the way Carpe Diem does its education. If you've ever noticed, if you want to research something on the internet, or if you're doing an internet, if you've ever taken a quiz or a poll or anything online, you have to be able to read to do it. And the kids who attend Carpe Diem, they have homework that isn't done on computers. I'm sure that for English, they have novels to read. And when you do standardized testing on a computer, reading comprehension, okay, you still have to be able to read. When you have a Nook, okay, you still have to be able to read. Now, you could do it through audiobooks for those students who have really severe dyslexia, for example. I had an adult student who simply could not grasp or use phonics. He had to learn to sight read. He had to memorize every word, because he couldn't connect the sound of an individual letter to its material representation. For him, he had excellent grades in high school, because he listened to every word his teacher said and remembered it. And I am an avid reader, ladies and gentlemen. You don't see me any day of my life when I don't have a book going somewhere, usually within arm's reach of me, including when I'm driving, but I don't read when I drive. But there's a book in my handbag or my school bag, or I have my Kindle with me, so that if I'm held up at a grocery store or I'm waiting in a doctor's office, okay, I'm reading. I really don't read a lot of the magazines because most of them are incredibly boring, but I have something to read. A love of reading and a love of books and a love of knowledge can be generated in a child with a computer as well, because you have to be able to read and understand what you're reading. Okay. To be able to do the material and advance to the next level. If you can't do the reading on that computer, you're not going to understand the material and be able to be tested on it. If you can't read, you're not going to be able to follow the directions on a package of food. If you don't learn to read, you're not going to be able to write down the answers to things that you don't do on the computer. And the students at Carpe Diem and other types of schools have that aspect of their learning as well. So I really don't think that that type of learning situation would eliminate the love of reading. I think it would encourage it because it would be directly related to an instantaneous measure of, look, I did this, I've mastered this, now I can go on to the next. Computers are great tools, ladies and gentlemen, and we have the technology to help our kids learn better. What we have to do is use that technology sensibly. We have to listen to its good points and use those, and listen to its bad points and be aware of the consequences thereof. We all need to bring back the lost art of listening, ladies and gentlemen, not only in our schools, but in our everyday lives. We have to stop expecting one-word answers to complex questions, or quick fixes, or easy buttons. We've got to stop expecting that all we have to do is go buy a gadget and all of a sudden the world will be perfect. We have to really listen, and we have to teach our children to listen. And then we need to speak out. The art of listening is what fuels the freedom of speech we enjoy. Babbling nonsense words is freedom of speech. If we aren't even listening to ourselves, how can we use that freedom positively to actually make real progress, not a false utopian dream, which the progressives are trying to sell, but real progress, so that everybody, has an equal opportunity to be all they can be. And that ability to listen and then speak and listen again is one of the underlying pillars of why we have the nation and the society and the lifestyle that we do. We are incredibly wealthy, ladies and gentlemen, all of us. This is the only nation in the world that has an obesity problem among the poor. Our founders wanted to create a climate in which no individual would be artificially elevated or artificially squashed. based on anything other than his or her innate ability and willingness to work. This nation was called for many years the land of opportunity. Not guaranteed success, not entitlement, not even freedom, but opportunity. The chance to take your best shot. We need to listen to the words of the Founding Fathers and understand what it was they envisioned, and teach our kids to listen. Listen with discrimination and with thought. Not just stand there with their mouths open when their hands out waiting for the next gift from Big Daddy government. We need to teach our kids that their education is not, oh, gee, I go get to play with my friends for 7.5 hours a day and get breakfast and lunch and after-school babysitting and then come home and play video games. In this particular country, if you look at demographics and high school graduation rates and those who go on to college and basic grade point averages, you will see that those children of Asian descent top the percentages all across the board. And the reason they do is because the culture in which they grew up and their parents grew up values learning. Not grades. Learning. Grades only reflect whether or not you've learned. We need to remember that learning isn't grades, ladies and gentlemen. Learning is knowledge acquired, thought about, digested, and built upon. And we need to teach our children that that kind of learning comes from listening. We can do that by precept, and we can also do it by example. We need to be listeners too. You all know, if you've joined me for this show before, that being a lifelong learner is something that I believe should be a goal of every person. And lifelong learners listen. They hear something and it catches their interest and they go and find out more. Or they ask a question if they weren't sure what it meant. They don't just sit there and think about the next beer or the next hot dog. They creatively listen and think about what they hear. If we can get our kids to do that by the way we ourselves teach them at home and the way we ourselves live our lives, then we will be able to fix the mess that our public education system is in. But we can't fix it if we don't listen to what's wrong with it. We can't fix it if we expect it to be something that it cannot be. We can't fix it if we expect it to take over our role as parents so we don't have to. And we cannot fix it if we assume that somehow or other any system of education can make life risk-free and success possible without effort. We cannot fix it if our children do not understand that their actions have consequences and that their freedom requires responsibility. We have to live that way ourselves. We have to be the kind of people we would like our children to look up to, emulate, and attempt to be like. We have to get off the couch and pay attention. We have to start listening to one another in the same way we listen to our favorite song or a really fascinating movie or a great speech that actually says something. Not the way we listen to a commercial. I think we can do it, ladies and gentlemen, because I have faith in this nation and the people who comprise it. I believe that Americans are exceptional because we have more opportunity than any group of people who have ever existed on this planet. We have more ability and more skill and more talent and more willingness to try something new than any society in history. And because we have those things, nothing can stop us from making things better. I want to thank everybody in the chat room for being with us tonight, and all of those of you listening out there in Blog Talk Radio land. And I hope that you'll join me again next Thursday at 6 p.m. for Patriot Education. And please visit our website, www.patriotfamilies.com. That's www.patriotfamilies.com. You'll meet a great group of people, ladies and gentlemen, who are listening, and they are speaking about what they hear. Come and be a part of the lifelong learners who listen and tell the truth. And your children will follow in your footsteps, and they too will be lifelong learners who listen and tell the truth. And that will make this a better nation and a better world. All it takes for evil to triumph, ladies and gentlemen, is for good men and women to do nothing. And I believe we have good men and women out there listening. And I know that they will not settle for doing nothing. Thank you again for being with us tonight, ladies and gentlemen. I hope you'll join us next week. And please stop by Blog Talk Radio every night of the week. On our website, www.patriotfamilies.com, on the homepage, on the right, you'll see a list of the radio shows we do here on Blog Talk. There's something for everyone. All of us are anxious to have you join us in the chat room or call in or just listen and send us a message on our website or put up a blog. Write a piece, make a comment, listen, learn, and then share what you've learned. Ask questions, give your opinion. That is what has made us a great nation, ladies and gentlemen, and that is what will keep us one. Because we will not lie down and be a slave to dependence. We're too good for that. We're too strong for that. We're too tough for that. And we're way too smart for that. Good night, everyone. Thank you again for joining us. And we'll see you next week. That's next Thursday at 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time for Patriot Education. God bless.